Ancient DNA has a lot to say about the people who walked the earth in the Middle Ages. Hello and welcome to the Medieval Grad Podcast. It's a podcast brought to you by medievalists.net, where we meet and chat with graduate students and sometimes early career researchers from all over the world to learn about the new trends and the future of research in medieval studies. I'm Lucie Lemonnier, a medieval historian and your host. And today I'm chatting with Reid Morgan, who's doing his PhD in history at Harvard University under the supervision of Dr. Michael McCormick. Hello, Reid. Thank you very much for being here.
Hello, Lucie. Pleasure to be here.
So, Reid, your background is actually in archaeology. You did your BA and a MA in archaeology at Cambridge in England, and your MA thesis focused on sea surface temperature variability in the Middle Ages. But you also did a master's in Anglo-Saxon, Norse, and Celtic studies, and now you're studying frontier communities in the Western Mediterranean. So that's quite like a travel. I'm wondering how you came for Celtic studies and sea temperature variability to communities in the Western Mediterranean.
Yeah, so I had long had an interest in archaeology going all the way back to middle school. And I came to undergrad at Yale thinking that I was going to go into the archaeology of the Bronze Age in the Eastern Mediterranean. I had worked a couple of summers on a site called Pylos, which was a Mycenaean palace site.
Wow.
But when I got to Yale, I continued the interest in archaeology, but also had this kind of side interest in the Middle Ages, which I was able to explore through the course of the liberal arts degree, and so did a lot of courses in medieval literature, in medieval theology, and those interests really continued to grow, and that was what led me in applying to the master's. And so the first master's that I wound up doing at Cambridge, the Anglo-Saxon, Norse, and Celtic, my interest had been in trying to formulate a question around perceptions of the natural world in the Middle Ages. So I'd been doing some reading of the bestiaries and the physiologist tradition, had gotten really interested in Isidore of Seville. Isidore of Seville was a bishop of Seville in southern Spain, who died in 636. He was the brother of Leander, one of the key players in the conversion of the Visigothic kingdom, and he himself fostered an incredible renaissance, which was a flourishing of intellectual culture. He wrote an encyclopedia, as well as numerous works on biblical commentary, theology, natural history, history. And so the first dissertation there was on Isidore of Seville's interest on Bede. And so Bede was the Anglo-Saxon connection. But in the course of doing that research, I became more and more interested in the world of Isidore, who really caught my imagination, is this fascinating figure in a moment of incredible change in Iberia, where you have the negotiation of what the religious future of Iberia will be as the Visigothic kingdom is converting from Arianism to Catholicism, as they're negotiating ethnic and political questions of what its fate will be vis-a-vis the Byzantine Empire and its presence in Iberia, as well as the Goths, and questions of Romanitas versus the Germanic identity. So a lot of these were kind of percolating in my mind as I was at the same time realizing that I really did want to keep the archaeology in some way critically engaged and didn't want to just go down a hole and pin myself as a literature person, though I wanted to keep that alive as well. And so that was what led me in the second master's to keep up some of the Anglo-Saxon, Norse, and Celtic world interests. And I wound up doing an archaeology project on Viking communities and Pictish communities in the Orkney Islands, looking at, again, from this kind of natural world, human relations with the environment angle, temperature and climate change, and some of the archaeological science interests that had grown while I was at Yale, but I hadn't had as much of a chance to apply. I was able to really learn and develop in the course of that second master's, working with snails from Viking trash dumps from the Orkney Islands, and looking at the ways in which the chemistry of the snail shell incorporates oxygen at a ratio which reflects the local temperature. And so by looking at different strata from within these trash heaps and the different snails there, we were able to look at temperature change over time.
Really unexpected.
Yeah.
I mean, well, from a non-archaeological point of view, like snails.
Exactly. The things you can find. And this is one of the things that I love about archaeology and the kind of frontiers that it keeps opening up is that you can find central answers to important questions in seemingly unrelated material. And so the way in which you can pick something like a snail and then answer questions about why people are moving in the North Atlantic at different points and how navigability is changing. So that's something I love and am hoping to continue to work with. But the interest again, and this was coming from the work on Isidore, had definitely started to really cement in the Western Mediterranean world, this world where the legacy of Rome was more alive, where the questions of what the Christian community would look like were embedded in an intellectual tradition that I really wanted to be able to grapple with in the course of my research. And so that's what led me in applying to the PhD to look back to the Mediterranean, where I had started all of those years back thinking it would be in the Bronze Age, and it turned out it was going to be in late antiquity in the early Middle Ages. And finding Professor McCormick at Harvard was just an incredible realization that all of these interests could coalesce, because here he's running a couple of initiatives, the Science of the Human Past, and a collaboration with some colleagues in Germany on it. So this is the Max Planck Harvard Research Center for the Archaeoscience of the Ancient Mediterranean. And there, the interest in ancient DNA really started to grow. And as I had been thinking about migration and identity in the course of thinking about the world of Isidore of Seville, ancient DNA emerged as a really cool tool for looking at totally new evidence for migration that could be viewed in parallel with the textual sources that we had been looking at, but really start to rewrite the population history and look at totally new angles of depth on how much we can say about how large these migrating groups are, where they're actually coming from, how admixed they are, how they're integrating with local communities, what kinship structures are like, where we can actually find individual relatives by looking at the genomes of different individuals in a cemetery complex.
Well, you already started talking a little bit about your PhD project. So could you kind of go back to, if I'm quoting your dissertation's title right now is Frontier Communities in the Western Mediterranean, Boundary Interactions in Late Antique and Early Medieval Africa, Iberia and Sardinia, 500-750. And so because there is a lot to unpack here, can you kind of sum up what you're looking at?
Yeah, so in thinking about questions of identity, I think one of the first moves that I've made in approaching this this dissertation is to think about what the framework for thinking of identity in late antiquity is that will be most profitable. And this is where I've settled on community, because I think community is one of the nexuses in which we're able to really think about the different variables that compose identity and avoid breaking it apart in anachronistic ways into just thinking about ethnicity or an individual's identity in some of the ways that I think scholarship can somewhat problematically move. The next move that I've kind of made is to think about where are the points at which communities interacting are most able to show difference and similarity through those interactions. And so this is what's gotten me really interested in frontiers, the places where different communities of very different or in some ways very similar nature and identity are able to abut one another, and the way in which that process shows and reveals the kind of internal processes that are leading to the transformation and negotiation of the structures of community. And then finally, I've been thinking about in the region of interest to me, what the different variables are that will allow a comparative study of how these processes are working over time. And so I've been thinking about regions with very different environment and how the environment and landscape use mediates the kind of interactions that can take place at a frontier. So thinking about deserts in North Africa and the way in which nomadic communities interact across frontiers, thinking about the kind of mountain landscapes of southern Spain, or islands. And this is where Sardinia, which is kind of the most recent addition to the project, has come in, and the way in which I've been trying to think about whether we can think of coastal space as frontiers, and the very different way in which interactions are mediated along a coastal means of mobility. Then I've been thinking about the different kind of political administrations and regimes. And so in the course of this period, 500 to 750, in the Western Mediterranean, we have the kind of transition between the Visigothic kingdom, the Vandal kingdom, the arrival of the Byzantines, the emergence of indigenous Berber kingdoms in North Africa, and the kind of Moorish polities, and the questions of how Roman, how indigenous, how Christian these polities are going to be, and how they'll interact with the new Byzantine presence. And then at the end of the period of interest, the arrival of the Arab and Islamic presence. And so each of these successive presences involves a process of renegotiation, and will allow me to think about how language, ethnicity, religion, changing over the course of time, changes the nature of these frontier dynamics.
So as you mentioned, you are using kind of traditional sources and more untraditional sources, which are ancient DNA. Could you tell us a little bit more about your sources and how you hope that they will help you answer the questions that you're asking?
Yeah, so the traditional sources that I'm able to use are a lot of chronicles, traditional histories, as well as the kind of theological writings and religious writings that show us a lot about how communities are interacting in negotiating this difference between East and West, between Arian and Catholic. And so those sources, I think, give a higher level kind of elite picture of the mental image that a certain subset of the populations that I'm interested in have for what communities are normatively supposed to be, how they're being ideologically constructed. And then we can ask how much that applies in reality on a kind of theoretical level. Then, so I have kind of three streams of evidence: the traditional textual sources, more traditional archaeological sources, which will be looking at the kind of built landscape and how that's mediating interaction, that can offer insights into some of the kind of life of common people in the landscape archaeology. Particularly for North Africa, we have some incredible surveys that have been able to look at a really detailed landscape and see small rural settlement as well as urban nuclei, but also the administrative landscape, so fortifications and military installations. And here's another area where there's a real difference between the different regions that I'm looking at, because the frontier in North Africa became heavily fortified, and there are many of these Justinianic period and later Byzantine fortresses, whereas in North Africa, the frontier seems to be much more urban centers defended with a rural hinterland that there wasn't as much Byzantine penetration into. And so that we can start to see just from the archaeology. And the archaeology can also show us some of the interactions across the frontier in terms of the mobility of goods. So ceramic typologies and looking at when and where different ceramic types are moving is going to be an important part. And then the final part, if there's the texts, the traditional archaeology is the bioarchaeology. And so that's where the ancient DNA is going to come in. And this is looking at cemeteries. The ancient DNA has really just taken off in the last decade. From where we had a handful of very partially sequenced fragments of DNA from some individuals, to where the methods for extraction and for analysis have gotten so good that we're getting full genomes from ancient individuals, and we now have over 7,000 of these, and it's getting to a pace where it's doubling each year, and it's just incredible how it's growing. But the full genome approach is enabling us to really look very carefully at detailed resolution of admixture of ancestries, where different ancestries are coming from. And as we have more data from more sites, from more periods in time, we can better resolve what that admixture actually looks like and what it reflects in terms of human movement and interaction. But we can also look at patterns of kinship, relatedness between individuals on a site, and we can look at questions of population dynamics, like how big is the mating pool? And we can actually resolve what population size within a given area might have been in a quantitative manner. We can look at things like how much close kin mating is there? Is there cousin mating? And that will actually show up in the genetic signature.
It's fantastic to see hard sciences and soft, quote, science like history finally working hand in hand.
And it's really exciting in doing it to see, I think, sometimes when these collaborations take place, one of the two disciplines can take the upper hand. And I think for a while in the growing discipline of ancient DNA, that had kind of been the case. And what we've seen recently is that I think the collaborations have become much more equal. And so the archaeologists and historians have really been pushing in the direction of, rather than taking single individuals and taking them as representative of whole populations, doing cemetery-wide studies where we look at all of the individuals in a cemetery from the DNA angle, but also the archaeology of grave goods and burial types and what that shows about status, and also the isotopes and what they're able to show about migration, because ancient DNA shows you ancestry, but it doesn't actually tell you if an individual has moved. But if you look at oxygen or strontium in that individual, you can actually track different places where the individual might have lived over the course of a lifetime, and carbon and nitrogen to look at diet. And by piecing all of these variables about status and identity and ancestry together, we can start actually answering really detailed historical questions about causality in the phenomenon that the DNA is able to reveal.
Yeah, I was also, I interviewed 2 days ago a PhD candidate at the University of Minnesota, and she's a zooarchaeologist. And so she was talking also about ancient bones. She was looking at cows in Ireland. And something that's really striking is that sometimes we have still this kind of Indiana Jones assumption that archaeologists are just, you know, dusting old stones and not at all working in a lab, actually meeting people doing that. You're like, oh yes, right. Yeah. So let's move on to the one before last question. Could you tell us a little bit, if you have some, about your preliminary findings?
Yeah, so a little tough to say. I have just finished the 2 years of my PhD that have been coursework and general exams. So I'm now just able to kind of fully launch into this project. But I think some of the really interesting differences that are going to be emerging, the relevance of landscape in structuring how these interactions are taking place. So the difference that comes about through deserts versus mountains versus water, and the kind of travel and the kind of economic activity that takes place there, and what kind of interactions that fosters. So I was just having, for instance, a very interesting conversation with my advisor about smuggling as one of the modes of interaction along frontiers, and how certain spaces incline themselves to making it easier for a political apparatus to observe trade and control it, and certain spaces make it easier to resist that on the part of the people themselves in these communities. One of the things that, in terms of a kind of preliminary vision that past historians have had, that I think is just starting to crystallize in literature, and it's exciting to see. And one of the differences that I think it gets emphasized in this work and will either emerge and be affirmed in my own research or maybe push back against, is this characterization of North Africa as having heavily fortified linear frontier, whereas Spain has been characterized as a settlement of coastal urban sites with very little interaction in the interior space. And that lends itself to two totally different kinds of cultural interaction on those frontiers and different senses of what a frontier will mean. And I think that too is probably one of the interesting questions I hope to be able to grapple with, is just what is a frontier? when frontiers can be such different things.
So thank you very much for this answer, Reid. And I hope, you know, your research goes swiftly and smoothly and that you can write a beautiful dissertation in a reasonable amount of time. And we want to talk about when are you done, which is the dreaded question. But instead, I'll ask you another question, which is a fun one. And it's, what advice would you give to a prospective grad student wanting to do research in medieval studies?
Yeah, I think the biggest advice that I would have is to find research areas and questions that allow you to combine interests. So this is something I've really found in the course of my own research and figuring out what I wanted to do, is there were all of these totally disparate, seemingly disparate rather, avenues that I felt I could have been going in archaeology, in literature, in kind of conventional history or archaeological science, and figuring out what were the places where I could be working, where I could bring those together. And when one can do that, I think the most exciting and in many ways the most novel directions start to open up.
And it's also a plus when you choose a topic that allows you to travel in very nice places.
Absolutely. And the food in the Western Mediterranean doesn't hurt.
Thank you very much, Reid. It was really great to have you on the podcast.
Absolutely. My pleasure. A lot of fun.
That was Reid Morgan, a PhD candidate in history from Harvard University. His info are in the show notes. Stay with us, because the episode isn't over yet. It's time for the second segment of the Medieval Grad Podcast, where I talk with Peter Konieczny from medievalist.net. Hi, Peter. How is it going? What did you think of the interview?
Wow, like working with Viking-era snails from trash heaps.
Yeah, that was something so surprising.
Yeah, yeah. You know, and it's, there's a lot of surprising things. Like if you start, you know, going down the path of like, what do they say, ancient DNA and being able to look at, yeah, it turns out like your research can go off into whole new areas. You know, like I'll be looking kind of forward to seeing, you know, what he can kind of discover. It's another area, like, you know, we don't really know too much about, like in medieval studies, is like North Africa, you know, like the Berbers, where, you know, when you have Berbers, the Byzantines, the Vandals, that's kind of like the early Middle Ages, you know, and it's something, you know, we don't cover too much. So, and especially the archaeological side, right? You know, we have the sources, but he's certainly going over new ground. That's for sure.
Yeah, and I think that something that's really interesting, and we talked about it in other podcasts, is the fact that so he's looking at the fabric of society and the humble people, kind of the real people, the people who lived in communities. And for these very ancient times, we don't necessarily have sources these people produced. So Reid will actually be able to learn a lot about these people, as he mentioned, what they ate, where they came from, who were their parents in a more ethnic terms. So I think it's really a fascinating window into the sort of very private life of these people of the past. And so it's very new, and I think he will write a wonderful dissertation.
Yeah. Yeah. I've seen in recent years a lot of news about ancient DNA. Yeah. You know, we mentioned the Max Planck Institute.
Yeah.
And they seem to be doing a ton of work, you know, looking at people and also looking at diseases like the Black Death. Yeah. And how they kind of spread. So, you know, we can put like a links, just a few of those kind of pieces, but, you know, they do, you know, especially when you look at people, they do tend to reveal things that we didn't consider, like, you know, people, intermingling of like various ethnic groups, because they're being buried side by side. And this is literally, researchers finding cemeteries, you know, extracting DNA from the bones, and then being able to discover all these kind of fascinating facts and traits about these people, you know. Yeah. And they sometimes, you know, they go against what like our written sources say. So it offers a lot of challenges for historians.
Mm. Yeah, I really encourage you listening to kind of look at all these bioarchaeological articles. A lot of them are actually available for free online. There are a lot about the plague. I use them. I wrote a piece for History Today, which is a UK magazine in history about the plague. And I mentioned some discoveries by the Max Planck Institute. And then later I got carried away and I wrote an article about childless families in the south of France in the late Middle Ages. And I used a lot of bioarchaeology because it provides kind of very strong proof of what you say. It's not just based on speculation. It's like, okay, so people studied X hundred of skeletons and they can assert that this or that happened. So I think it's very interesting, and that Reed's research kind of looking at archaeology, bioarchaeology and textual sources will really build very, very interesting
facts on the ground, right?
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
We've talked about it before, but it's like interdisciplinary research is kind of the way to go these days in medieval studies, right? Like, think of how you could, bring the archaeologist, the biochemist, the linguist, historian all together in the same room. And what can we all kind of learn about, right? His project looks like it's going to fall in that same vein.
Yeah. And so if you liked this episode, you should listen to the one about animal bones. It was a zooarchaeologist. And in the next couple of weeks or months, there should be an episode, and it's a news. Peter, you are not even aware of that. But I'm going to interview someone who's doing marine archaeology and looking at barrels found in shipwrecks around the Mediterranean and the North Sea to learn about medieval networks of exchange through barrels.
Wow. So
it's going to be great. I think it's going to be great. I really love that kind of, mixing of disciplines and new perspectives on history.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
Thank you, Peter.
Hey, thanks.
You are listening to the Medieval Grad Podcast, brought to you by Medievalist.net. If you want to support us and this podcast, you can subscribe to our Patreon, patreon.com/medievalists. You can get a lot of neat benefits on Patreon, including being able to hear these episodes early. We love doing this show and we really appreciate your help. I'm Lucie Lemonnier. You can find me on Instagram at the French Medievalist, and you can look me up on academia.edu. Thank you for tuning in. Au revoir.